Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we're discussing that most vexed of generations, the millennials. The oldest millennials are now, whether they like it or not, turning 40 years old. They're often mocked by older people as Generation Snowflake, but do millennials, in fact, still have quite a lot to complain about as they move into middle age? That's the focus today. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Every generation likes to think that they've had it the toughest. One generation, though, has perhaps more claim to that dubious honour than the others. Millennials, usually defined as those born between 1981 and 1995, have faced a string of financial barriers in their lives that means, for the first time in modern history, they face worse outcomes than the generation that preceded them. Or do they? As the oldest millennials turn 40, how do those common conceptions stack up? And what challenges still lie ahead for so-called Generation Snowflake? To talk it over, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, it strikes me this is likely to be a bit different to the discussions that you and I usually have on the podcast. But I do think it's an interesting topic and an interesting way to talk about how different generations view their finances. Why don't we start with what the data tells us about the financial prospects for millennials, and in particular about their incomes, because that's pretty fundamental to anyone's finances. What do we know?
Hi, Ed. What we do know, of course, is that millennials, the generation you're talking about, have had a couple of bad experiences in their, relatively short working lives so far. Obviously, the last couple of years they've been through the pandemic along with everyone else. But roll back 12 years and early on in their working lives, so probably when they were in their mid to late 20s, they lived through the financial crisis. And I think the crucial point about that is that they lived through that financial crisis when they were very new into the jobs market, and all the evidence is, the sort of academic research on this suggests that if you lived through a depression or a serious recession, just as you're getting going in your working life, then it can actually scar your experience for the rest of your life, and you are going to probably have less secure employment. You're probably going to experience lower wage rises than the luckier cohorts who came into the jobs market when things were in a healthier condition.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to make, Tom. Everyone suffered in the financial crisis. Everyone suffered less job security. They might have lost their jobs. That could happen at any age. But you're right, at that particular age, for this cohort that we're talking about, that's, you might have done a few years of your career by that point, you might be established in a career of some kind, but it's often, your late 20s, your early 30s, this age group essentially, when your earnings start to accelerate, maybe you move on to the second or third job in your career, or you get promoted, you're put in charge of stuff, and that's when earnings tend to accelerate, and that's sort of what was pulled out from underneath this group of millennials. We're kind of talking about the older millennials, I suppose you could say here. But what we talk about in terms of their income is borne out in the data. I've looked at this, Tom. We've got lots of ONS earnings data that shows the rise in wages for this 30 to 39 age group between the years we're talking about, so between 2008 and last year, actually, 2020. Their wages rose 18%, but that 18% rise was the weakest of any age group, apart from the very young workers, those under 17. And in real terms, of course, that 18% rise was, in fact, a wage cut of 9%. And that's versus 2% cut for the 40 to 49-year-olds and a 3% cut for the 20 to 29-year-olds. So it does seem to be an effect on that age group that isn't reflected in other age groups. So millennials have had a tough time in the labour market. That clearly makes financial security harder to achieve, Tom. But it also feeds into another area which is always talked about when it comes to millennials and how they've struggled versus older generations, and that's the housing market. What can we say about that particular challenge for millennials?
Yes, I think it has been particularly tough for that age group because of what happened to the housing market in the period immediately following the financial crisis. Because you have to think about, what were the measures taken by governments to dig us out of that economic hole that we found ourselves in 2008, 2009, and specifically the measures taken were designed to boost asset prices. And of course, that was absolutely fantastic if you happened to be in the lucky position of already being on the housing ladder, you know, if you were a baby boomer or even, you know, Generation X, so born before these millennials and you'd already got on the housing market, then, you know, you were sitting pretty because the value of your house was rising. But if you were struggling to get onto that housing ladder, then it just became increasingly difficult over that 10-12 year period.
Indeed. And you know, the stats will tell us the story here. You know, millennials were half as likely to own their own home at the age of 30 as baby boomers were. The financial crisis was a crisis of credit and the banking system, wasn't it? It made borrowing harder to come by, even though what you say there, Tom, you know, efforts were put into loosening up that financial system, but it did lock lots of people out of borrowing. It the requirements to raise a deposit and what have you just became much, much harder as a result of all that was going on.
Yeah, so it was really a double whammy, wasn't it? I mean, not only were house prices running away from people, but even if they wanted to get on the housing ladder, it was difficult because the credit, as you say, just wasn't there. So it was an extremely frustrating period for people of that age in their you know, late 20s, early 30s, when you would normally expect to be jumping onto the housing ladder and buying your first property. You know, many people, as we know, were unable to do that. They carried on in expensive rented property or, you know, even worse, they were forced to continue living with their parents or to bounce back and go and live with their parents after they had the experience of moving away, perhaps when they were at university. So, yeah, tricky.
And I mean, you mentioned there that they might have to rent for longer. I mean, that has a real world impact because the houses that people are able to live in, they're probably smaller than they would otherwise be. I was looking at statistics that said the space that the average renter has nowadays is about 32 square meters in housing terms, but that's versus 40 square meters back in 1996. So that's 20% less. I mean, there's a story to tell there about the housing stock and our inability to build houses, but that's where you...
And not just that, Ed. I mean, it's also a product of very high property prices. Yeah. You know, what you find is that property owners, landlords, and I've experienced this recently with, you know, with my children who are now in their 20s and are trying to get on the housing market. And they're looking at flats, which, you know, frankly, are ludicrous because they are, you know, they are essentially one bedroom flats, into which, you know, a second bedroom has been improbably squeezed, you know. Yeah. And it's, you know, I look at some of these flats and I think that is just absolutely absurd. But it's a consequence of very high property prices.
Yeah, and that's clearly going to have a knock-on effect in terms of what you can do in your life, doesn't it? I mean, you know, it's difficult to have a child, for example, if you're a couple living in, you know, one of these studio apartments where you've essentially got two rooms to live in. The stats say that millennials spend almost 25% of their income on housing, and that's higher than any of the preceding generations have.
I'd actually hop in there, actually, Ed, just to sort of, you know, put a slight counter argument to that, because, you know, I mean, one thing you have to factor in, of course, is that interest rates are extremely low at the moment. So, yeah, it's true that millennials are spending 25% of their income on housing, but so were we, actually. I'm a late baby boomer. I mean, I suppose, you know, 1963 is probably the end of the baby boom, isn't it? It's on the cusp of baby boom Gen X. But, you know, when I was getting into the housing market in the late 1980s, interest rates were, you know, in double digits. I mean, I think when I bought my first flat, almost at the worst time. I mean, interest rates briefly touched sort of 15%. So, you know, which in today's terms is just inconceivable. No one could possibly imagine interest rates at that level. But it did mean that, you know, on relatively, you know, low starting salaries, we were paying out a very high proportion of our income on housing costs.
Fair enough, Tom. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and it's an important point to make, actually, in these comparisons between generations. We're looking at some financial measures, and some of that you can measure. And you know, you might not capture it all, but you can measure some of it. Other things in life are just beyond measurements, aren't they, Tom? I mean, it's difficult to put a value, and we don't really seek to in this conversation, of putting a value on, you know, one you know, life experience versus another. There's lots of silly arguments that I've had about, you know, people spending money on avocados and smartphones, and would you rather have those things or would you rather have full employment and affordable houses? I mean, a lot of the intergenerational sort of warfare stuff is a bit silly, right?
Oh, it is silly. And absolutely, the point I'm not trying to make is that, you know, oh, we had it tough as well, because, you know, frankly, I think that well, what is it? So sort of 17 year age gap between the two of us.
Yeah.
You know, frankly, I think that my generation did have it much easier. I mean, I was in a position, you know, as I say, in the late 1980s, when I was not earning a huge amount of money by any stretch of the imagination, but I was able, you know, with my then girlfriend to buy a flat, and then 3 or 4 years later to buy a 3-bedroom house. You know, that experience actually probably seems a bit inconceivable to people 20 years younger than me.
Indeed, indeed. And all this, Tom, makes obviously saving money much harder for that age group. If your income's being hurt and you're having to spend more on housing, there's less money for other things, and especially less money for saving for retirement. Now, tell us about the retirement prospects of millennials, Tom, because yet again, there appears to be another sob story to tell.
Yeah, I mean, there is a sob story to tell about retirement. It's not necessarily just aimed at millennials, because I think what we're talking about here is this transition from these sort of gold-plated final salary, defined benefit pension schemes, which you know, older generations typically enjoyed, but actually, the last generation of people really to have that benefit is getting pretty old now. I mean, you know,
yes.
I'm coming to the end of my working life, and I've never had a defined benefit
Indeed.
Pension in my life. So that has definitely affected older people too. And really, the vast majority of people, I would say everyone in working life currently is probably not a beneficiary, or very few people outside the public sector are beneficiaries of those final salary pension schemes.
Yeah, indeed. And I think even in the public sector, actually, that they've been sort of reformed to a point where they don't really resemble those very, very generous ones of old. And there's a point here to make about auto-enrolment. So auto-enrolment into an employer pension scheme, which is based on the money you put into it and maybe your employer puts into it. Auto-enrolment started in 2012. So there was suddenly lots of people that weren't saving towards a pension suddenly were doing so. But even then, contributions were very low, set at a very low minimal level. And even now that they've risen a bit, it's still unlikely to give people most people the retirement that they want. So saving for retirement, particularly now as this age group moves into, well, middle age, dare I say it, at the age of 40 and above, where you are a bit closer to retirement, you can see it coming over the horizon, and a lot of millennials are going to start thinking about their retirement quite seriously quite soon, you feel, Tom?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is clearly a problem for that generation. Again, it was a problem also for the slightly older generation. I mean, I know myself, I came to pension saving rather later than I would be recommending to younger people, and for very understandable reasons. I mean, you know, when people are in their 20s and 30s, especially if they're dealing with a difficult job situation and a difficult housing market situation, there are lots of other priorities for your money, and retirement seems a long way off. And then suddenly, as you suggest there, you get to 40, you get to 45, and you think, I've got a problem here, and I need to sort it out. I've got a lot of catching up to do. And of course, you know, the best time to start saving is 10 years ago, always. And, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah. And another sort of important point to make about that shift in pensions. We talk about pensions being less generous than they were in the olden days. To drill into that a bit more, specifically what you have with someone saving into a defined contribution pension, which is most of us these days, you're shouldering the risk of that, aren't you? You've obviously got to come up with the contributions, notwithstanding any you might get from your employer. But what happens to that money then is kind of on, well, it's not on you, but you shoulder the risk of it underperforming or it not growing to a level that you need it to. Whereas in the olden days, that would be the risk shouldered by a large pension scheme. And so it's just another one of these ways in which that generation are being asked to sort of fend for themselves, perhaps in a way that older people weren't.
Yes, and I think that's probably one of the hardest things for people to get their heads around, because, you know, I mean, you know, we happen to work in this business, so we have some sort of understanding of, you know, what's going on and the pros and cons of different approaches. Whatever. Many people just, you know, don't have the interest or they don't have the knowledge to do that. And so it's very tough to then put that responsibility on people. And it does require a lot of personal responsibility, which, as you rightly say, older generations just never had to think about it. I mean, you know, for anyone with a defined benefit pension scheme, it's just essentially a continuation of their salary. They're just not working for it. I mean, from the perspective of today, it seems like an incredibly luxurious position to be in.
Yeah, it looks very odd, doesn't it? All this, Tom, is a bit depressing, frankly. So let's look for some silver linings here. One area where millennials, at least some millennials, could perhaps do better than previous generations is when it comes to inheritance. We've spoken about, you know, baby boomers having done so well. Well, you know, they have children and they will pass that wealth down. And it's going to be millennials, well, as I say, some millennials that get the benefit of that.
Yes. And if you'll forgive me, I will. I'll turn this portion of the conversation on a slightly depressing route as well, because I mean, the problem with inheritance, yes, it's absolutely true that for some people, there are relatively big inheritances coming their way because of the house prices that we've already talked about. The problem, though, is that many people, because of extended life expectancy now, they're actually going to be receiving these inheritances relatively late in their life, probably not until their 60s, you know, by which time, you know, the moment for needing a house and, you know, with a growing family, etc., will have already passed. So absolutely fantastic to suddenly get a nice windfall when you're 60. You know, it'll pay for lots of nice holidays, but it's probably not the time in life when you need it most. And the other point to make, I think, which is a really important one, is around this question of inequality, because inheritance is largely about passing housing wealth down the generations, then clearly we're looking at a divide between, you know, the haves and the have-nots, the owner occupiers and the renters, and that is going to be perpetuated by this money cascading down the generations.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, that you see that a lot when you look at this sort of economic demographic type stuff. You've got, yeah, you know, wealthy baby boomers are likely to be the parents of wealthy millennials, and those wealthy millennials are likely to pair off with other wealthy millennials, and you just have this concentrating effect all the time. And so, as you say, it increases inequality, albeit, you know, in aggregate between the generations, it's a good thing that millennials are going to get that money, you'd think. Actually, I wanted to ask you, Tom, you know, about you've mentioned your kids, and I guess the eldest of yours actually probably is slightly young to be a millennial. I don't quite know, but they would be very young millennials if they are.
Yes, I think my oldest was born in 1993, so I think okay, that just about technically makes her a millennial.
I wanted to ask about your sort of experience of their experience, if you like, because I'll declare my interest. I'm 41, Tom. So I mean, you sometimes see definitions of millennial that would include me. I don't particularly feel like I'm a millennial. I feel a bit more like I'm Gen X, although a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about is very relatable to me. But it seems as though, thinking back to that time of people my age and slightly younger, it really felt like, sort of adult life and career life and sort of financial life, there was a sort of pathway, a conveyor belt that you were supposed to get on, buy a house, move to London, climb your career that sort of way, not necessarily move to London or whatever, but have this sort of career path. And a lot of that was upended by the financial crisis, by the things we've been talking about now. And I think that the people that are younger than that, maybe the people that are sort of the age of your children now, Tom, they'll get the benefit of that experience. Perhaps, they'll be in lots of ways affected by these things in just the same way. But they've been sort of forewarned about some of this stuff. They might be planning their life in a different way, certainly about where they want to live. They might frankly want to skip the whole kind of buying a flat in an expensive city thing, because the world is changing, isn't it? You might not be tied to a city anymore. And you just think that you would hope for the people that age, their options in life expand a bit and they can make smart choices so that they can circumvent some of these financial challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? I mean, you've mentioned quite a lot of things there. I mean, that actually is several topics for probably several podcasts, yes. Because it is a fascinating this generational shift is really interesting. And actually, you asked me about my personal experience. I think I probably have both of those principal experiences that you talk about. I mean, my oldest has actually gone down that route of, saving extremely hard and making some real sacrifices, and with some help from me and some sort of matching of her savings, with a lifetime ISA, etc. Yeah. She and her partner, she couldn't have possibly have done it by herself, but she and her partner have managed to buy a flat, and they've done, what you said was probably the experience of previous generations.
Yeah.
But her younger brother, he's not on that same sort of path. And I think for him, the prospect of ever being able to buy somewhere just seems, a million miles away. So it's a really interesting conversation to have. And I think there'll be another divide in that generation between the ones that do decide to do that and those that just say, do you know what? I'm not interested in that. I'm going to take a different route.
Yeah, well, good for them, I say. Look, let's try and end, Tom, with some practical points here. Rightly or wrongly, millennials, whatever age they are right now, they're going to have to overcome these challenges in time. I mean, that means saving more, doesn't it? At the end of the day, it means saving early if you can, making the absolute most of any help that's on offer in terms of tax relief on pensions, on employer contributions for your pension, perhaps. Tax-free saving inside ISAs. You mentioned lifetime ISAs. They're going to be an option for people. You're going to need every sort of tool in the toolbox, aren't you, to get round this stuff?
Yeah, you're right, Ed. Circumstances change and the backdrop changes, but the arithmetic remains the same. And, the arithmetic tells us that, the sooner you start and the more that you can save and the longer that you can do it for, the more likely you are and do it in the most tax efficient way. And that makes it more likely that you're going to achieve your financial goals. But, let's not pretend that it's not going to be tough, because it is. It's hard work.
It is indeed, Tom. OK, well, that is all we have time for today. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.